market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast. Well, it's not up as much as car prices, put it that way. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, Andrew Page. How are you, buddy?
I'm very good, mate. How are you?
My intros need a lot more work, do they not?
Well, you've only had, what, 200 episodes to practice, or so you don't want to you want to ease into it.
Mate, another 200, I'll be just hitting my stride. We should. It's more than that, though. It's not like 400 or 500 episodes. It's some stupid little
number. I knew it was a high number, and I reached and like I randomly had 200, but I knew it was a lot.
Shoot scores. At least 200. Well, the more episodes we've done, the more right I should be, and frankly, the more disappointed I should be in myself for not getting it right. Let's quickly leave that behind, edit that out later. Mate, I cannot start this podcast. Well, so normally I would ask you what straw man was.
Mm-hmm.
This time, I want to ask you what straw man premium is, because I understand that since we spoke last, this thing's kind of come to life.
Yeah. So, well, look, it's kind of the next stage of the journey. We wanted to sort of form an inner circle of our best and brightest contributors and form a genuine investment club. And so it's, yeah, we launched it. So today's Thursday, we're pre-recording it. We launched it a little while ago, and mate, we're almost halfway through capacity. So
wow,
who knows, by the time it goes to air, we could
might
well
be late. Filled,
but I'm really psyched about it. Yeah. So we've got some really smart cookies on there. Hopefully we can turn over a few rocks and find a few good opportunities. But yeah, that's, so Strawman Premium is Australia's premier online investment club. And yeah, if we've got any space left, come check out the website.
How should they find Strawman Premium? Is it just strawman.com or is there
just go to strawman.com. Yeah, you can. You can also create a free account, check it out, and yeah, hopefully you'll come join us on that inner circle.
There you go. Andrew is the founder, managing director, chief cook and bottle washer at Strawman, and a lovely bloke. As you know by now, if you've been listening here for this long enough, if anyone deserves success, it's Andrew. So go and check out strawman.com.
Thanks,
I should just keep your former boss and my current boss, Bruce, happy. I should also mention the Motley Fool does investment advice. And if you're going to also join Strawman, do me a favor, just so I can keep my job and keep the podcast going, join the Motley Fool as well. As much as I love giving you a free plug, mate, I say free plug, you're doing this for free, so it's a quid pro quo, but I probably should at least put the flag out for the Motley Fool from time to time. So join Strawman at strawman.com and then come across to fool.com.au and join us as well, because, you know, the more the merrier. What do you reckon, there's 70, 80% overlap between our membership bases, do you reckon?
I reckon it's pretty high. If there's people out there that like to manage their own money, they're going to come across one of us. So
it's a really cool community. And the two very, very best investment options in Australia. If you're looking for investment ideas or advice, I don't think you can go past strawman.com or fool.com.au.
We might be a bit biased, but I think it's fair to say.
I think Strawman's great.
This is a shameless.
Great. We're all happy.
This is really shameless at this point, can I just
Let's
say.
Move on. All right. So, the problem is, I said move on, and we're all happy and, you know, laughing, having a good time, and then I'm about to mention the absolute, I'm going to keep it in PG, mess that we have in, capital city of Australia, the premier city, the largest city in Australia, that is Sydney. That is, since we spoke last, officially,
in
another
four
weeks with a lockdown. Well, you can say that, except that right now I'd almost rather be in any other city, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
you're stuck in your house. I can't get into the city.
Fair point.
Maybe it was the best city. Maybe it'll again be the best city, but right now it's lockdown central. And, mate, so let's not obsess over what's relevant for us. We're talking to a national and an international audience. We regularly have listeners from around the world as well as around the country. But what happens to Sydney happens to the rest of Australia almost by definition. A, because those numbers get national. B, because there are flow-on effects. We talk about it every week, mate. And I'm kind of sick of talking about it. On the other hand, it is the dominant economic and business story, and we kind of can't give full value to a business and finance investing podcast without at least referencing it. The new news this week, lockdown. Okay, let's get that over and done with. We're locked down for another 4 weeks in Sydney. Inflation, 3.8%, more than double the rate of wage growth. So for those who want to do those maths, if inflation is greater than wages, that means living standards are falling. We are getting less for our money than we were in the past. The CBA is tipping 300,000 jobs to be lost over this downturn period, and a negative quarter of GDP growth. One more of those and we're back in the R word, recession. Makes me scared to even mention the word, because I don't want to tempt any fates. Not that the fates care enough about me to cause a recession as a result. But, mate, I think I might have even said last week, but I love doing media normally because I get to say how well things are going. The last week has just been really, really disappointing. I did a Motley Fool video for our members, US members, actually, yesterday. And Margie, who I was speaking with, she said, "Oh, it breaks my heart a little bit to see you so despondent." I was like, "Well, I'm not despondent, but it's kind of, there's no good news. I can't spin this one. This is just kind of ordinary news across the board." I guess, you know, without asking you the same question I ask you every week, but given the new news, are there any companies, industries, investment ideas you're avoiding? Are there any that are looking attractive? Do you, you know, we don't invest for the short term. Neither you nor I do that. But sometimes you get a sense that, you know, either the market is missing either an opportunity or a risk, that somehow shares are too cheap or too expensive as a result, that some industries become more or less attractive. How are you processing the last week's worth of news?
Oh, mate, you're always leading with such a big question. So
yeah. That's also why I ask you first, because you answer that, like, your good bits and I repeat them. I seem really smart.
Oh, where do you start?
That's so it. Well, it's been such a big week.
Yeah, right. So firstly, with like New South Wales, Sydney in particular, it's something like on its own, just as the city itself is something like, what, 20% of the national income?
It's much higher, I think. I actually saw something in the 30s, is the number I saw yesterday.
I thought 30 might have been all of New South Wales, but
maybe.
Either way, it's a very, very big chunk. And the thing is, you know, although we've been in lockdown for, what is it, 5 weeks or so now? The thing's getting worse. I mean, today we've just had numbers that were like, I have to say, we've sort of, even getting used to high numbers, they were really shocking today. Yeah. And the number of young people in ICU, it's just like, wow, this thing, I think we were all pretty complacent to it at first. Yeah. A bit battle heart weary, I suppose. And yet, on top of all of that, and you mentioned sort of some poor economic news, the share market's at record highs. It's never, ever been higher. In fact, add dividends in and it's well beyond its record
highs. I was going to mention that, actually. That was my next question. But yeah, that's why I'm kind of trying to work out the difference between the economy and GDP never actually march in lockstep. So that's the first thing we need to remember. Mm-hmm. But to your point, I don't blame people saying, what the heck is going on when the market's up and the economy's in the toilet? Who's getting it wrong, or what am I missing?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't know. I actually gave up long ago trying to sort of peer inside the head of the quote unquote market. It's just such a nebulous thing. It's hard to know. And to your earlier point, like, you know, what am I doing? What opportunities there are? Yeah. I think to me it circles back to something that it's one of these things that you just always do. And so you know, whenever you buy something now, no matter what it is, there's a dark, uncertain future. You know that there's always going to be some negatives that come. You just don't know when, like recessions. You know, like one-off cyclical kind of factors. So when they come along, it sucks. It's not as if these share prices remain immune and these companies are untouched. But at the same time, they're the ones that I think I've at least got conviction to sit through. And if I've got a bit of extra cash, actually buy more, because it was always part of the investment plan. It's like, I'm not buying this thinking that the future is absolutely rosy. But it's a kind of business that will withstand that. And I still think in 5-10 years' time, it'll be a much bigger business. It sounds really simple, and it kind of is. The hard part is actually sitting through it, because you kind of say yourself, and then over the next 3 months, you watch your portfolio evaporate.
It doesn't matter. Oh, it really starts to matter at some point, right?
And that's the hard part. It's just remaining, it's keeping your eye on the price here, which is, but has what I bought actually fundamentally changed? Is what's happening on the market a true reflection? Yeah. It's a really hard thing to do, but I'm old enough and long enough in the tooth to know that we always look forward at these things as risks, and we always look in hindsight at these things as opportunities. I try to flip that around as best I can and not play any sector, but just always play the game of high quality, long term potential. Mm-hmm. It solves a lot of problems.
Yeah, I like reflecting back on every time I go to say back on the COVID recession, my mind immediately goes to GFC. I was about to say again, go back to the GFC. Going back to the COVID recession, I was early. I bought Webjet shares at way too high a price, right, in February. And so I made that mistake, but also I kept buying through March, April, May, and June. And overall, the Webjet thing was obviously a mistake, but I'm much better off for having kept buying regardless. Yeah. Are there companies, industries that get interesting to you right now? Do you actively go and try and find those that are overcorrected by company or by industry or by price? Like, you know, there's two schools of thought. One is, look, I can't wait to buy CSL and Woolies when they're on special. The problem is that when Woolies falls 20%, their overall market's probably down 50, and it's almost the last stock you want to buy, right? Because if you're looking for absolute bargains, you want the ones that have fallen furthest in theory. then again, if you want to quality portfolio, you're better buying Woolies at a discount of 20% than buying it at full price. How do you think about where you go shopping, if and when the market does take a tumble?
I'll give you, I'll extend and torture the shopping analogy. Imagine imagine if I'd won like a, you know, $100 all you can buy shopping spree bonanza. You know, and they open the doors and you've got 5 minutes to rush in and pull stuff off the shelf and run to the cash can, and it's all you get whatever, $1,000 worth of stuff.
Yep.
So if I was to do that, I would answer your question in one way. And it does seem that if you ran into the shop, you would see, oh, wow, airlines have really taken a knock, or tourism stocks or retail stocks, and this is where the opportunity, oh, this is the thing I'm going to buy. But I guess I approach it more as someone who's already thought, before I've even headed down to the shop, I've already thought about what I want and what, and I think I've got a pretty clear idea of what's good value.
Okay.
And so it's more about just going to the things that I know I already want and seeing if that really makes sense. Because I've already done the work, I guess. When I'm trying to react in the moment to the current situation, I just find it's not that it's something that you couldn't do or shouldn't do. And if you've got the time, I'm sure there's a lot of investors out there that find a lot of rich pickings. But for me personally, I'm busy enough with the way that I sort of do things. And that's more about just, you spend a lot of time reading about stocks and nothing's really happening with their share price. There's no real news about it. But when it does happen, I'm reacting in context. It's not reflexive. Right. It's more targeted, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's having a plan
and kind of putting the plan you already have into action rather than trying to formulate the plan on the run.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely got this wish list of companies, and I'll look at all of them when markets move around and then sort of make a decision there. But I won't take my focus off. I've been doing this for a while, so I've already know a lot of companies that I'm just not interested in, even if they drop 50%. Yeah. Even though there's probably potential money to be made in that situation, I just prefer not to go with, you know, I've got the luxury of choice, so why bother with those kinds of companies? So even when they do offer opportunity, I'm just happy to stick to my knitting. If that makes sense.
I was going to make the same point. Yeah. There's a sense that the type of investor you are probably and want to be determines what you should do at different points. If you're an investor who likes to try and, I won't say trade, but take some short-term positions or short-term positions, you might want to play kind of counter-cyclically, right? You want to buy the gold miners when gold's cheap, or you want to buy car, we'll talk about car sales in a minute. You want to buy car companies when new car sales are through the floor and the share price sucks, and you want to kind of ride the wave. That's a very different thing to what you and I do, which is largely, hopefully, holding for very long periods of time, letting compounding do its own thing over multiple years, maybe for multiple cycles, where you really start to put those things into some sort of perspective. So I guess I'm just saying, you know, there's nothing wrong or right necessarily with how anyone wants to invest, although there's some people who do it terribly and people who do it very well. But making sure you stick to your knitting was the way I was going to answer the question. So I'm glad you kind of
know what your knitting is in the first place, right? Like, is it a sweater or is it a beanie? You know, have at least that goal.
Oh, we're
in
torturing
mind.
Some metaphors, man. We are torturing sure are. Until they scream right now. Okay, so let me go. I can't think of a good knitting analogy. Unfortunately, I'm not that au fait with knitting, mate. You'll be surprised to know. So I can't quite keep torturing it that far. I'm going to just put you on the spot. What is your knitting? If you're someone saying, you know, what is it? How do you invest? What do you look for? You're saying to people, look, don't do anything differently because you kind of expected this would happen. I'm going to just keep doing what I do. What is it that you do as an investor? How do you describe your own knitting?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's something that's evolved over time. I'm a pretty different investor now than I was 5 years ago, and you know, I could be a different investor again in 5 years' time. But where I've found the best success has been trying to focus. I like companies that are a bit under the radar, so maybe a bit smaller. But at the same time, it always makes it sound risky. I really want to emphasize at the same time, their businesses, I feel, have pretty strong balance sheets, have proven product and services. They may not always be profitable, but at least they've got something and the sales growth is really strong and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess it's sort of looking for long-term compounding machines. And they're pretty rare. Like there's a lot of noise around, you know, these sort of things that, you know, companies have strong moats and yada, yada, yada. And it's all true. But I think, you know, genuinely companies that really fit the bill really well are pretty rare. So I spend a lot of time trying to sort of find them and then work out a price I think is sort of fair. And then I try to just buy it and then sit on it for hopefully 5, 10, 20 years. I mean, the best returns I've made have been from doing nothing. And more often than not, when I've had a really great investment, the worst thing I've done is just get in the way and sell some of it on the way up, thinking I'm doing something clever. But it's really trying. I'm not trying to sort of snag 20% or 30% here, or you know, I'm really just trying to get on board for a long term partnership, like a marriage, you know. And it sounds corny and it sounds old fashioned, and I know it's not for everyone, but for me, I've just think. The great thing about investing is that you sort of, you buy a bit of a company and then someone else does all the work. You've got a CEO. And, exactly. To be honest, I feel as though I spend my time finding that and then just like, get the hell out of the way and I'll ride the ups and downs. But it works out so well because it's something that you don't get much instant gratification in, which is why I think it's on one hand, it resonates a lot as Australia. You hear a lot of great investors talk about it, but few people do it because there's no easy win, and or if you do, it's very rare and it's just through luck anyway. It's a slow grind, but the results really pop out after a while.
Yeah.
What's your knitting?
No, I was going to say that. So you talk about change and you talk about sort of some of that gratification. Before I do the knitting thing, I'm not a dividend investor necessarily, but is there anything better than when cash just arrives in your bank account for doing literally nothing, right? Like I love getting paid for working. I love even more getting paid for not working. Like I showed my wife the dividends we received. It was from an ETF a couple of Fridays ago. Like, look at that. It's like, oh, that's not bad, is it? Like, I know. Yeah. Literally, they sent me money. Now, I had to give up some money. I gave up some future consumption. And there's all that, you know, investing is not free. You have to not spend it and save it and all that sort of stuff. And there are sacrifices you make. But when the money just literally drops in, it's like, oh, my goodness, that's amazing. And is it amazing because it's brand new or surprising? No, of course not. I've been doing this for more years than I choose to count. But it's just still really, really cool. Go on.
I'm just going to say one thing I've noticed over time is that you sometimes the compounding power really jumps out. So when you first maybe buy $1,000 worth of shares and you get a few dividend checks, that's nice, but you know, you're hardly going to go out and buy a Porsche with what your dividend check is. But when you add to it over time, it really does get to it. Like money makes, here's, you know, Captain Obvious here, but money really does make money. And when you've had those situations, so if I really like for 5-10 years and longer, it's like, holy S, that's a lot of cash that comes in. So I know that feeling and it's a great feeling.
Yeah, it is. And it's so, I just want to reflect on that. Man, I wrote an article yesterday. I'm just trying to find it, so if I can find it. But I wrote about the false dichotomy. You and I talked about this a lot. And part of our conversation was what inspired me to write about it yesterday was that idea of value versus growth, right? And I think you and I both think that's a stupid argument and not very useful. If only because it's undefinable anyway. There are very few value investors who don't want their assets to grow. Very few growth investors who say there is no price too high for this asset.
Yeah.
So by definition, they might be at different ends of a spectrum, but it's the same bloody spectrum. They're joined at the hip,
as Charlie Munger said, right?
Exactly. So I think, you know, if I think about how this plays out, I think it's a very fair. I understand why people do it. I understand why they feel they gravitate to one or the other. I started, as you said. The reason I mention this is because I started as a value investor. I've said before I had 60 ratios on Microsoft Excel, 95 or whatever it was back then. Typed all in manually because you couldn't get annual reports online, all that kind of good stuff. It kind of makes some sense. Equally, growth makes sense, right? Who doesn't want to buy the next Amazon at $3 and see it go to $3,000? Of course you do, right? If that's a growth stock, well, hey, sign me up.
Yeah.
Firstly, the economy is silly. Secondly, I kind of describe myself as a quality investor, which is another label which isn't super useful, but it's really to kind of underline the point that I used the example when I wrote about it. I own both Amazon shares and Soul Patts shares, Washington H. Soul Pattinson. There aren't many more different companies. If you try to have two companies up ends of something, and I was trying to think, okay, why do I own both of them? And it's not because I think they're both the same in any way, shape, or form, but because I think they're both quality businesses. And if you can own, but Warren Buffett talks about, you know, time being the friend of the quality business. What does he call it? I just can't remember the exact quote now.
Friend of the quality business and the enemy of the poor, I think.
Of the mediocre, right, exactly. So to me, that's the thing, right? It's like, you know, whether you're trying to get ultra growth or whether you're trying to find some great managers, you just want to let them compound away. And by the way, Soul Patts has got 15 years worth of market beating returns despite being one of the most boring sounding businesses in the country. And so
cracking track record for Soul Patts.
Right. And so what is it? It's quality. Now there are people who, I don't know how many people in Australia have both Amazon and Soul Patts in their portfolio. I would imagine not many. I think we could probably fit maybe a couple of phone boxes,
it's a small overlap on the Venn diagram.
You would think so, right? And so that was the point was I'm looking for quality where I can find it. And on the basis that, and we kind of talked about this at the beginning, the longer I hold them, the better I expect to go. And that's kind of the point, right? You want a business that you think is going to be able to continue to improve over the long term. So A, you never have to sell. B, you don't have to worry about cycles and, you know, changes of management and that kind of stuff. You're just buying great businesses and holding them for as long as it makes sense to do so, which is hopefully forever. So, again, I'm reluctant to use another word as a label, you know, what's quality, what's not quality, value growth, all that kind of stuff. And yes, some people even buy crappy businesses and make money because they buy them super cheap and sell them slightly less cheaply. But for me, quality is the answer. Man, I'm looking for quality businesses I can feel good about that, back to your point about, you know, letting the CEO do his thing or her thing. Great. You know, Robert Milner at Soul Patts, Jeff Bezos is now the executive chairman, not the CEO anymore of Amazon. But man, if those guys are minding the shop, I'm not like, you know, good. That's two less things I have to worry about. And I think that for me is, you know, I'm not trying about it with the share price gone from 13 cents to 14.5 cents, or whether the business is, you know, mildly underperforming or greatly underperforming. It's like, I'm just going to let them do their thing. They're good people with good businesses, with great cultures. I'm just going to let them go.
I think that's the greatest advantage of that approach, because there could be someone else equally out there. And again, as we say, each to their own, but let's say there's someone else out there who day trades and gets a 5% extra annual return to you.
Mate.
Well, that's a better return. And over time, that's going to compound to a much more significant return.
Yeah.
But as one thing I always think that people overlook is if that is the approach you're going to take, and this is why it doesn't resonate for me, although I acknowledge that for some people they far prefer it, is that it's so much work. You know, it's like, what?
Right.
You're like talking about getting the dividend check before. Yes, there's something that rocks up in the mail while you're, you know, twiddling your thumbs or knitting a pair of, you know, socks or something.
Yep.
Is far better than the one where you're stuck in front of four screens reading every company four announcement. And you know, it's just it's a hard grind. There's something to be said for profit per hour input or something like that. It needs to be a metric that's introduced.
Not only that, mate, we're let's not do day trading too much, but if you're day trading for a quid, you got to pay your hourly wage plus you got to try and make some money, right? So if you do 5% better day trading than I do working, it depends on what salary I'm on or what salary you're foregoing, but I'll tell you what, that 5% better be on a large amount of capital, because 5% of $1 million is only 50 grand a year. We'll say only. Mm. If you're earning nothing day trading and you beat me by 50 grand a year, if I can get a salary higher than that, then dude, I'm still, you know, after expenses, if you like. It's like looking at the property yield, not taking out the cost of upkeeping the house, right? Like you don't get to just say, look at my gross return. You've got to say, well, actually, here's the net return after everything I've put in.
Well, it's not just the hours spent too, it's the quality of those hours. So that's a profession. Day trading is a profession that can be very hard. So if you don't like to sleep feel too sick to
feel
eat,
like kicking and, the cat,
and then all of a sudden feel as though you're the greatest person alive, and then go back into another slump, and then feel like fantastic, you know, that you got to weigh that up too.
Exactly. All right, let's move on. I just want to kind of unpack that, because I think that's useful when we think about, we talk a lot about, hey, don't worry about the short term, and I think that's right, and we are right to say so, but our listeners may well have thought, okay, then what? So we've just done that a little bit. I mentioned car sales before, mate. This is a heck of a time to be selling cars at all. New car sales volumes through the roof. Used car sales prices through the roof. We should see some rich car dealers right now, right? If you're selling new cars, you're selling a lot of them. If you're selling used cars, you're selling them for a fortune. This feels to me a little bit like a transitory dislocation, I got to say. It's not very often you have both high used car prices, I should say, and high new car sales. Normally, if people are eschewing the new cars because I'm not sure, well, you pay a bit more for the used ones. When everyone's rushing out to buy a new car, you'd expect that used car sales prices fall because all the demand's on new rather than used. Both happening at the same time is kind of nice, but I feel like someone's going to lose from here.
See, this is another example of one of those things that it's hard to draw a line between what's happening in the world and what's happening in the market. So
exactly.
If you look at AP Eagers, which is the biggest dealership group, you know, again, you'd think, oh, wow, you know, up to a third of the economy is in lockdown. I'm sure a lot of people are. It's the classic textbook example of a discretionary purchase.
Yep.
Like in every course that's ever been taught on the subject, like a car is given as a highly discretionary purchase that you can put off if times get a little bit scary and times get a bit uncertain. I won't try and explain it. Someone smarter than me will give it a crack, I'm sure, but it's just a good lesson that you can you wouldn't, if I told you one fact, you'd never guess the other
right
half of that fact,
right?
Is,
exactly,
is I guess what I'm saying.
Yep, you're right.
Yeah
I'm still assuming it's a timing thing. So you mentioned to me before we started recording, used car price up 30%, I think you said, was that roughly right?
You read the figures out, didn't you?
No, you read the figures out. That was all good. Maybe I read them back to you. In any case, and new car sales are up strongly. In fact, AP Eagle's share price, by the way, has doubled in 12 months as new car sales continue to grow. This is a really weird economy right now. I'm glad I'm not an economist, right? Like, it's easy to be an investor when you just go, you know what? I'm going to buy quality when I find it. I'll hold it for the long term. Who cares what happens? Why not? Who cares? I mean, of course, we care about people who are, you know, impacted by recessions and other things. But from an investing perspective, I don't have to try and untie that knot. And if it's too hard, I'm simply going to walk away. Like, I don't have a view on AP Eagers, or Eagers Automotive, as it's called these days. I don't need to have a view on it. I'm glad they're doing well. But yeah, it's a weird world when used car prices are up, as I said, because in theory demand is higher, which is fine. Normally, though, when used car prices get high enough, people would go to new cars, and then used car prices should fall, and vice versa. Can I just quickly jump straight to our next topic, mate? Because if you can't explain car prices to me, at least explain the iron ore price, will you? The iron ore price of $215, $216 a ton right now. Rio BHP Fortescue cost them $15, $16, $18 a ton to get out of the ground. They are selling the stuff for 90% gross margins. And every single economic textbook we've ever read, mate, says that's not possible. It's supposed to be the case that high prices, high margins attract more competition and produces more volume, and that pushes prices down, a bit like our car example. And again, this one, just like new car sales, I've been on... Frankly, I had someone who didn't like my Facebook posts, as it turns out, messaged me, had a go at me for saying something on Facebook, which I'm okay with, and then said, and by the way, I don't know how you've been wrong on iron ore for that long. And I kind of felt a bit aggrieved by that, but I also don't blame him for having that view, because I've been saying for 6, 7, 8 months that the iron ore price just like purely a law of Spider-Man, it was just unsustainably high. Now, I didn't make a forecast of when it would fall. I never do that. I've been around long enough to know that's just dumb. But still, this guy's like, dude, you've been saying the iron ore price is too high for how long? And BHP and Rio have done spectacularly well. Rio Tinto reported earnings on Wednesday night this week. Their profit was up 271%. Their dividend for the half year, $7.50 a share. That's something like a 5% yield on the half year dividend. That's double that. Good. That's a 10% yield.
Yeah.
It's, you know, COVID's bad enough. It's just tempting to kind of go, I don't know what's going on anymore. The old rules don't apply, and I don't know what the new rules are. But I mean, am I missing something, mate? Should I be just throwing the towel on iron ore? Like, how do you look at that and go?
I hear what you're saying. Yeah. So there's a big difference, just on your earlier point. There's a big difference between if something will happen and when something will happen. So I don't think you're wrong on the fact that something is likely to happen, and you never said when it would happen. So it's worth teasing those two things apart. Let's look in the last mining boom. You know, it's from 2004 to 2008. Rio went from, $25 a share to over $100 a share. It was a great time, right? To be a miner, right? And then demand fell away, and we had all those problems. And then it was, you know, in 2016 it was back to $40 a share, and then we've had a pretty good sort of run since then. So it's sort of, you know, the normalizing factor comes in, because there is always iron. I think is the third or fourth most abundant metal in the Earth's crust. So it's actually you know, it's hard to get to, and there's not just it's not just lying around. But if we need it, and there's enough of an economic
incentive, WA.
Well,
you just scrape off the ground in the Pilbara.
Yeah, so when margins are really low, there's just no one's going to bother, right? Why would you bother digging a hole when margins are like this? I'll dig a hole.
I mean, I'm going to check the backyard on the way out when I finish this, mate. Just dig a bit of a hole, see what I can find, because it might be worth it.
So that's why these companies are particularly hard. So I think you're right. I think I would bet a great deal of money that at some stage we will see prices or margins, I should say, come down. When it's going to turn, I've got no idea. Great, geez, that's an incredible dividend though that you said. You don't see that for the half year very often.
That is remarkable.
Enjoy it.
Here's the other thing. So I mean, while I'm here, while we're talking about iron ore, we don't very often, so I might as well stay here for a second. I still marvel. Can you imagine what a ton of iron ore looks like, or how you would get to a ton of iron ore? Right. A ton, 1,000 kilograms, a ton of something. They mine it and put it on a ship for $15. Like, think about the scale of an operation. And, mate, that's part of the story, frankly, why the margins are so high, is because they can push costs down so far. Pre kind of the big guys getting bigger, I want to say the cost of iron ore was something like $30 or $40 a ton, I think. Kind of the average cost for most of those kind of mid-tier miners was about $30 or $40 a ton, which even then is still stupidly cheap. But if you think you can dig a hole, find enough iron ore, get rid of the, what do they call, over something? Come up with the call now, I don't follow it close enough. Overburden. You get rid of all the overburden, the stuff you don't want. You just get the iron ore out of it. You refine it. You do whatever you need to do to put it on a ship. And it still only costs you $15 for a ton, for 1,000 kilos of the stuff. It's remarkable.
We often talk about commodity producers, and one of the unappealing things about them is they don't tend to have any of these competitive advantages.
Yeah.
You know, you've got no pricing power, but it is also fair to say that there are scale advantages. And so if you were someone who was going to get into mining, and look, as I said before, it's not my bag, but if you were, when you've got someone who's got such scale that they can put that on a ship for $15, it means that when the price does come back down to more typical historical levels, they're still profitable, where a lot of the high-cost producers sort of won't be. So they are definitely the ones that you should focus on, and that is a huge advantage to them. So that's why it's always worth looking at the mine life, the amount of capacity and reserve, access to ports. So people who get into the mining companies really can make a bit of a science at it. But that's what you have to look at. You've got to go beyond that first level thinking of, iron ore is going high, so I'm going to buy Rio. That's a rookie error. If you know the kind of companies that are best placed to benefit from that and can sort of stay afloat and still deliver shareholder value when the tide does inevitably turn, that's where you want to, focus your gaze.
I think it's a really good point. I've also heard mining described as a supply chain with a mine at the end.
Yeah.
Think about, not only do you have to get it up, you've got to get it to the port on a ship, including that $15 or $18. It's just phenomenal. Let me ask then, mate, are we too quick to reject miners on some sort of old school? What's changed? And there's plenty of stuff to change over our lives and certainly over our investing lives, things that we wouldn't have touched that are now worth touching, things we would have touched that are now no longer attractive enough because circumstances change. What would have to change? If I was to say to you, at gunpoint or close enough to it, mate, I need you to rethink your investing approach. When does mining change sufficiently that we kind of go, okay, well, I didn't like mining for reasons that were true at the time, but, the old, when circumstances change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? Quote. I guess I'm left asking myself, and it's partly rhetorical, and I'm partly asking it for the sake of asking it, but this part of me is thinking, well, actually, at some point I've got to start looking at myself and saying, dude, either you're wrong or things have changed, or just ask the question of how much am I leaving on the table if I assume that the old rules still apply?
Well, it depends. It depends on how you're going with what you're doing. If something you're doing is not working, then you might want to change your approach. So that's the first thing. The other thing, it comes back to what we were talking about at the start. It's just knowing thyself, right? So I really don't have any ideological, philosophical objection to people who want to invest in mining. I just know myself well enough to know that my circle of competence lies elsewhere. I don't have any great edge or insight into the industry that's going to help me compete against a lot of people that do. So could things change? Well, I maybe if everything gets completely bombed out and something's trading at close to book value and you feel as I would never say never, but it's. There's enough things I do that know that are generally true about these kinds of companies that I feel as though there still remains better opportunities elsewhere. But that's just me. But if things got super bombed out, I know there's a lot of good friends I have that love these kinds of things and make really articulate, sensible cases. And if I was going to back that as an idea in the space, I definitely would. But as I say, it's just not for me.
It's hard, isn't it? It's hard. I'm tempted to agree. That's my default position, is exactly that. But I also wonder, people ask Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger all the time, if you could develop something, develop a circle of competence, where would you develop it? And I do wonder whether, given the prominence of miners, I wonder how much I may be missing out on, just a rhetorical thought, by not going down that path and sort of saying, oh, it's too hard, can't do it, not worth doing. I think, man, if that was the case for something that was actually, imagine doing it for tech over the last 20 years and kind of going, I could learn about it, but no, I'm not going to.
Yeah.
If you miss the Amazons, the Facebooks, the Netflixes, the Googles, the whatevers, and I own a couple of those, it would have been fine to say, well, it just wasn't so complex, that's okay. On the other hand, it's not unreasonable to kind of go, would it have been worth maybe putting some effort into that one, Scott? Do you think you should have done something about that? And I'd probably have to say, yeah, I should. And I guess I'm trying to hold myself accountable a little bit to not just going, no, I'm going to justify my current prejudice rather than genuinely ask myself if maybe something has changed. Maybe it's time to have another look.
Well, came back to what I first said. If it so turns out that technology has been a very core focus of mine for a while, so it's I'm not losing any sleep by going, oh, you know, geez, why did I focus there when I could have been in mining, because technology's been fantastic. So I'm not losing it. It may well be. But you know, I also feel too, the longer you sort of stay in a sector, the better you get at it. So
That's true.
Yeah. It's a tough one, mate. I don't begrudge anyone who does it. I can think there's real value in doing it. It does. Some of these miners look as though they're enjoying times that are just fantastic. You know, everything's sort of lined up at the right time, and that's brilliant. Yeah. But I don't know enough, as I've just explained very clearly, I don't really know enough to give a super informed view on a Rio or a BHP. But I would say anyone who begins to look at it and do their due diligence, just factor in some of the considerations we've been seeing, because, you know, margins and prices won't always be this high. Even though they could double from here and then stay high for a year or two, at some point there'll be a financial gravity that kicks in.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, let's move on a little bit. I want to go straight to this one, but I'll come back to tech, because we're going to kind of go via another company. We spoke last week. You were going to mention a company. I don't even know if we said what name we were going to cover. We're going to cover E-Road. It was a company you wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
And then I ran out of time entirely. So it was my fault. And I did promise. I think I promised on the Sunday podcast. We'll be back on Friday or something. I can't remember what it was now. My mind's like a sieve, unfortunately, these days. I'm getting old. In any case, you're going to mention E-Road to our listeners. That's an exciting new ASX business that is worth having a look at. I should say it was covered as one of our stock of the week picks recently. So if you have been listening to this podcast series, you will have heard about that from, I think Ryan gave me the summary on that one. But you want to talk about E-Road, mate, and I thought it was worth just giving you some time to think about it, because it's relevant for a few reasons. One is, I assume you think it's a good business. Two, it's sort of business you actually cover, and so to some degree this is a bit of a chance for people to get a sense of the sort of businesses you look for and what you look for in them. Tell me about your thoughts about E-Road, mate.
Well, I'm not here to give it a pitch and convince people one way or the other. The reason it came up for us originally is we were talking about the podcast, what's in the news, and they just announced a big takeover. So it was on my mind. But and the other thing to disclose is I do own shares, and it ranks very well on Strawman. So bear all that in mind. But it's a business that, what's attractive about it is they sell basically, I think, very advanced Navmans that help manage trucking fleets. In fact, now that I mentioned Navman, the founder and CEO was the guy who started Navman. And obviously that's gone the way of the dodo. Was very successful with that business, by the way. Now that's now become a feature of mobile phones. But in this area, there is one of the things I really love, Scott, is where there's new industries that are opening up that are global and that are growing very fast. So they operate in an industry that didn't exist 10 years ago. But it's also one of those, it's like so many of these tech companies. It's also a company that, you know, that in 10 to 12, let me not say company, a sector that in 10 to 20 years will be much, much, much bigger than it is today. Whether these guys are the winners or one of the, who knows, but at least when I look at my crystal ball, you kind of think, well, what in the modern day, in the Internet of Things and all of that kind of stuff, what trucking fleet is not going to have these kinds of devices when they, you know, genuinely deliver so much value and efficiency and accountability and regulatory requirements and insurance benefits and a gazillion things. And so that's nice total addressable market, big opportunity. But what's more than that, and that's usually where a lot of specky small cap stocks start and end. Hey, we've got a huge total addressable market. But I think
a billion people in the world, buy my shares.
Exactly. We're selling donuts, and if everyone buys one, we're going to make a squillion. But what's interesting about these guys is they are one of the market leaders. It's a Kiwi company that basically dominates the market. Well, not dominates the market there, but has moved into the US before Australia, in fact, and is just growing like the clappers. This new acquisition is going to see them become even more of a major player. They've got a good technology advantage. They're very sticky, these products. Another thing I like about this space. So like when you get a customer and they've got the unit installed, well, they kind of stick with you year after year and just keep paying their subscription fees. So a lot of traction, a lot of sticky, high customer retention, very strong balance sheet, very, very competent, proven management team, and one with significant skin in the game, which is another thing I like. So it's a lot of themes that just sort of line up with this one. So this is a good example of what we're talking about before. So it's kind of gotten up to around probably about fair value at this stage. I wouldn't call it a bargain. But, you know, back when COVID hit last year, it was one of the stocks I was buying as much as I could have, frankly. Because as they say, it was like, well, you know, is all of a sudden... The reason they went into the US, by the way, is the big regulatory requirements that are happening there. So there was this huge tailwind. So this is not going away. It's only strengthening. And they definitely had trouble with new sales in that period. But guess what? All their existing customers continued to buy and use and expand their product set with them. And now that that's over, everyone's catching. Because it's a structural industry-wide transition. Mm-hmm. That was the same theme for Pro Medicus. That was the same theme for Nanosonics. It's the same theme for Catapult, all writ large. And yeah, so that's the short answer, believe it or not. I could keep crapping on, but I like it. I think it's a really cool business.
Nice. Mate, let me ask you. I'm looking at this business and I get what it does, and I get why it does it, and I get the size of the opportunity given the likely move toward safety, road usage, tolling, all that kind of stuff. And I've got two competing thoughts. The first is, it reminds me of those, and I know it was a different type of device. I haven't caught a taxi for a very, very long time, mate, but it reminds me of those little devices that were kind of plugged into taxis, had a little security seal thing over the front of it so the cabbie couldn't tamper with it, that set the fare and the distance. And it was kind of one of those things where the government said, you got to have one of these devices in your taxi because we're going to control how much you charge and what you do.
Are you talking about cab charge?
No, the little, you know, the meters, you know, the taxi meters.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And had those little wires on it with a little clamp on it, so taxi driver couldn't open it up and use it, and so change the amount you were being charged. It was basically to make sure that, the distance was fair and the charge was applied appropriately. And you know, back in the day, you know, if you could tamper with that and charge people twice as much money because you tampered with the meter, then you know, it was obviously not okay. Then you have Uber that comes along and not only disrupts the entire taxi system, but the whole charging thing is done by GPS separately anyway. And so on one hand, I get the size of the opportunity. Imagine, you know, every truck, every car, or a vast bulk of them with an E-road style, taxi meter style device, just to, again, keep it simple for me because I'm a simple man. On the other hand, I see the Uber solution where it's like, well, hang on, wouldn't you just get the car manufacturers to do it or use GPS or something else? It wouldn't require a third-party device, or you know, there's some other device that capturing all the measurements done by somebody else, and E-Road goes the way of the NavMan, which is separate device that was once upon a time required as an additional piece that then kind of supplanted by a car feature question. Or something else.
So a couple of things. The first thing I'd say is actually when you reminded me of cab charge, because how insanely great was that as a business?
Yeah, exactly.
For the longest time.
Yeah.
Because of all of those things, it had to be there. It was just, and they could charge that, whatever they exactly. liked.
Yes.
And shareholders in cab charge, is it still listed? I don't think it is anymore. Maybe it is. Anyway, I haven't looked, but it was insanely good. And then there was the structural change. The difference I would say is with E-Trade is that they are at the front of the structural change. So it's not a device like a NavMan where everything was on the device. It is that stuff that then gets sent back to the cloud, where someone in head office monitors the position of all the trucks, the temperature in the thing, how long the truck driver's been awake, how many breaks he's had, that's recorded all the vision from the dash cam and sent that back to a central server and had it processed and compared this with that. So it's kind of like, it's. I hear what you're saying, but if there is disruption in the space, this is where it's at, and these are the guys sort of at the forefront of it. So that might not be true in 10 years' time or something, but the nice thing about it is that even though it's sort of like, it's not pure software, it's a hardware-software business. Hardware is just it's not the hard part, because it is, as you say, it's literally just a GPS and a Wi-Fi router, a 4G, 5G router. Other than that, all of the smarts, all of the value of the company is actually in their software, in the cloud. So it's a good point that you make, and it's the kind of thing you need to think of, but it's not one that worries me too much.
I like it, mate. Let's kind of move from there then to tech. And I want to kind of finish with this. I won't finish with this. You make me talk about something else at the end, but I'll pretend I'm not going to talk about that yet. Alan Kohler wrote a great piece in, I want to say, the New Daily today on technology stocks. And he made a few different points, and the major point he was making is actually not the point that I'm going to go with. He talked about the big tech stocks being kind of privacy pirates, and that's arguably true, depending on your take on it. You feel free to talk about that if you want to. But what I far preferred, and something we've talked about before, I don't know if we've talked about it in the podcast, but you talk about basically, you know, tech as a descriptor being. Well, I won't paraphrase him. I'll tell you what I took from it, so I don't put words in his mouth. But basically, being a useless terminology, he said, you know, Amazon is a retailer.
Yeah, totally. I agree.
You know, for Afterpay is a financier. And to some degree, once you get to call them tech, you can attach triple-digit PEs and you can pretend that these things are somehow magically different, better, unusual, whatever. And it buys you phenomenal cachet in the market. It seems to, again, I won't say Alan Collins saying this specifically, feel free to read his article. He, by the way, runs or is involved in a competing business to ours, but I don't really care about that. He kind of makes the point that, you know, what is tech? I've written the other day, yeah, tech in the 1900s was cars. In the 1950s, it was photocopiers. You kind of think, well, you know, is Amazon really tech? I mean, sure, it uses technology, but then who doesn't use technology? I mean, if Amazon's tech, then Woolworths is tech. And of course, people then say, oh, don't be stupid. Of course, Woolies isn't tech, but of course, Amazon's tech. It's like, well, tell me again. You know, just because their shop front is the internet rather than a physical shop front, is that all that's required? In that case, call it an internet business, sure.
Yeah.
But is it really a tech business? And I'm torn, mate, because I think Kohler's right. I also think there are some benefits and advantages bought by being largely internet-based or technology-based that does make a difference. I mean, Amazon is different from Woolies in some really important ways. But does it deserve the same tech, in air quotes, multiple as Afterpay, as Facebook, as pick your company? I don't know.
I think that's true. Sorry, I was going to say, I think that's true. I think it's not true what you're saying, but it's true outside of tech as well. I mean, you could have two mining companies next to each other.
Yes.
You know, one's a pile of dirt with someone who's drilled a core sample. Another one's a multi-billion dollar operation. So, you know, even within very well-established industries, you have chalk and cheese. And I do hate these. I do hate a lot of these labels. I think just because you use technology doesn't make you a technology company. And I think that even if you want to call yourself a technology company or retailer, whatever you want to call yourself, if you're a smart investor, you're weighing up its value, not because it's got a handle on it that says technology, but because of its economic capacity and what it's likely to do. Now, look, if technology gives them a bit of an edge that others can't easily replicate, then fantastic, and then some really nice features with that. But for me, you've always got to draw it down. You've got to draw it down to that very rational, economic, hard-nosed perspective. And frankly, that is why, as much as I love tech and as much as my focus, so far at least I look at a lot of these tech companies with regret because I didn't buy them because I was too fussy on price. but
really,
I think
I guess that's Kohler's point, right? If they're still overvalued now, you weren't too fussy. The market is just too nuts, and we don't try and predict short term share. Yeah, if your style was, I'm going to try and pick the companies that other people are going to overhype before they do overhype them, then you made a mistake. If your argument is, look, they wanted me to pay a dollar, I think it's worth 50 cents, just because it's $10 now, I still think it's worth 50 cents. That's not a mistake in the sense that, you know, the method, the process, the goals are still exactly the same. And yes, it still remains overvalued if you're right.
Look, so FOMO is a really hard emotion. No one thinks that they're susceptible to FOMO. We are. I think it was a Oscar Wilde quote or something who says that, you know, there's nothing worse than watching your neighbor get rich. I think it is so true when it comes to us humans.
Yep.
So, but I've gotten better at it. Like, you could pick a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't go anywhere near that would have, you know, in hindsight, would have been fantastic. But you can't let that get to you too much. I think what you can do is one of the things that I have gotten better at is not anchoring. So when you do see missed opportunities, you kick yourself. Right. But I think the best bet is always to remember, okay, well, dust myself off. Let's have a fresh look at this. Maybe I've missed something here. Now what do I think it's worth? And maybe you'll get an opportunity. Even if you pay a higher price than what you could have, doesn't mean that you won't still get an opportunity to get good returns from here. So as long as you can de-anchor from that initial bias and you know, look at things anew, you'll potentially get opportunities. But yes, I do think that there are a lot of technology companies out there today that are a bit crazy when it comes to their valuation. I wouldn't go near them. Okay. Afterpay, we've talked about before. I think that you know, when it was $130 or something, I was very, very keen to say that. As much as I think the company's got a lot of nice attributes, it's just not worth that much to me. At least I said
that at $20 too, mate. So I'm not going to throw rocks from this end. it's a well. This is so. I will just throw the other side of the argument for the sake, then we'll move on. But that there are things that technology-based companies can do or parts of their business model that are different from physical retailers, for example, right? Amazon can scale stupidly fast relative to Woolies. Afterpay can scale stupidly fast compared to Westpac. And so their ability to grow, to capture larger geographic markets more quickly, that is the one area where I think tech is probably the wrong word. But I think I'll argue against myself here. Getting caught up on the word tech, I actually missed the point. Because if you've got easily scalable, fast-growing businesses, they happen to be tech because that's what tech allows. So to some degree, you know, is it growing fast because it's tech, or is it tech because it's growing fast? They're probably, you know, it's probably that's the distinction it might be worth making. But to some degree, if Afterpay does justify a $200 share price at some point, it will be because you design the software once, you go and sell the hell out of this thing, and all of a sudden, you know, Woolies can't sell groceries in you know, London, New York, or I don't know, Auckland. Without setting up stores, supply chains, whatever, Afterpay has got to just kind of say to a retailer, hey, could you mind just, you know, when they pay, click, press this button. I mean, it's not quite that simple, but it's not much harder than that, mate. The sheer size of the market, and again, your donut example comes to mind, but the sheer size of the market and the pace of growth, I'm arguing against myself to some degree, but to me, it is that sense of it may not be that tech is enough, but there's also... Again, I talked about before about, you know, looking at mining again and saying, have the rules changed? I think the ability for businesses to grow and scale at pace and using technology where you're buying it once or you're inventing it once or you're building it once and then you can use it as many times as you want, it is to some degree, I mean, that does turn the world that we knew when we were kids on its head. If you were analyzing a business, you couldn't, you know, there are some things you pick yourself up from the 1980s and say, right, go and analyze Woolworths. And you do a really, really good job. But if I said to you, go and analyze Afterpay, and you've been born, you've been in deep freeze since 1980, you couldn't get close to the valuation until you actually were able to comprehend what actually has changed, which is just that sheer speed, pace, and scale.
Yep. It's been an epiphany that I was late to the party on, but was still plenty early enough to take advantage of. And I say that because I think that's probably still true. So I'm old enough to remember, I was working in the industry at the tech boom. And tech wreck happened. Yeah. And everything that people were saying about the internet, as I've said before, it actually came true. I mean, it was sort of like, obviously it was a bubble and there was a lot of ridiculous pricing involved in there. But the broad thesis of what technology meant and what it could do was true. And we've seen it play out over 20 years. And I genuinely think in terms of our kids will look back at our age at what the internet is today and go, it was laughable. Like the way that we look at Ask Jeeves in 1999, it's just all the first version of Twitter. It was just, you know, we were cavemen. So I think that doesn't mean that you just put any price on anything. I'm not saying that. But I think that as an investor, you need to embrace that idea that these are at least potential outcomes for these kinds of businesses. Yeah, and you should value them. You should value them accordingly. While at the same time not being too, you know, ahead in the clouds.
Yeah, it's a good point. I just think it's really important to break it down past the labels both ways, right? Tech is not enough, but equally Amazon and Woolworths aren't just retailers in the same way. And I think if you can manage, work through that nuance and understand the difference. I know I'm an Amazon shareholder, I'm not a Woolies shareholder. I actually love Woolies as a business. It's great culture. One of the businesses I would love to own it if it got cheap enough, and I missed an opportunity about $20 a couple of years ago, which I'm still kicking myself over. There's a remarkable lesson, I think, in when the differences tech has made, and by the way, doesn't make, and why you shouldn't just, as you say, mate, buy or not buy any miner just because they're a miner. You shouldn't buy tech just because it's tech, nor should you assume that all tech must be there for just retail or just whatever it is. Netflix is not just the same as Event Cinemas or Channel 7, right? There are very, very different things about that business that are worth mentioning. Mate, before we finish up, I don't really want to talk about this thing, but you're making me. We were going to mention it last week. We're out of time.
I know what you're going to say.
Well, I was going to mention it last week, and I was feeling really good about it last week, mate, because Bitcoin. I own a little bit for the record, $100 worth, was $63,000 back in April. And last week, it was about $29,000. It had more than halved in 3 months. And I was going to make a bit of a song and dance, have some fun with it because, you know, who doesn't like to pick on RAM? that's what I do. Unfortunately,
fun for the whole family.
Unfortunately. Well, so it halved between April and July. I'm still ahead. I'm still going to claim bragging rights. But since almost exactly this time, actually it was Tuesday this week that hit a low. Tuesday last week hit a low of $29,789 US. It's now back to $40,000 US. That's a 30% gain in a little over a week after halving over the previous 3 months. It was more fun when I got to say, ha, look at Bitcoin. I don't get to say that quite so much anymore, although as I said, I'm still taking bragging rights. It has been all over the place. It jumped when, of all things, Amazon put an ad out for a digital currency and blockchain manager, or whatever they call the role. And all of a sudden, that's all you need to do. If you work for a big tech company and you wanted to make some money on Bitcoin, you'd buy some Bitcoin and do something like this. Just say, oh, we're looking for a digital currency manager. And then just honestly, the thing went nuts. Yeah. And again, it's a reminder to me, regardless of whether or not this becomes a long-term asset, you have a view, I have a view, and frankly, I don't think either of us have a particularly strong view. We have an inclination as to one way or the other. But it's just a reminder that, like all things, but maybe like nothing ever before, Bitcoin is trading on sentiment in both directions, mate, in a way that is just hard to grasp, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
Amazon might hire a blockchain digital manager and the price goes up by a third. Again, halving over the space of 3 months, where not really much else has changed either. How much is sentiment, mate? Two-thirds, three-quarters, 90% of the movements these days in Bitcoin are sentiment?
Not 90% in the short term. I mean, it's just insane. It's
crazy, hey?
I saw a really great chart a little while ago which had shown the drawdowns. So what you do is you just measure the distance top to bottom on all the times that that's happened. And it's like, so you miss that scale on something that's generally gone up and to the right over time. But if you just take the latest high and then measure down until you hit a new high and then measure down from there. I mean, this just happens all the time. It's kind of like, okay, but what's changed? The price has changed and the price has changed radically. Right. And it's because Elon Musk has tweeted something or Amazon, but what's changed? Nothing has changed there.
Yeah.
I had a lot of mates say, oh, the Bitcoin's fallen as if like it's a big gotcha moment. Like, has it? Okay. I mean, I could also say, I don't, because I don't think there's any credit in saying this either, but I could also say, well, it's actually gone up fourfold in the last 12 months.
Right, exactly.
You know, and I'd be a total douchebag to pretend that I expected that, and that, you know, my thesis was is that sentiment's going to be such that it's going to quadruple in the next year. I don't know. And so it is a lot of fun, but for me, I've always said this is something I think that genuinely the technology is at a very early stage, hyper high risk, but it's one of those things, whatever blockchain currency emerges as the dominant, I think the upside is just insane. So for me, it's one of those investments that I put a small amount in, because if it goes to zero, it's like, well, no harm, no foul. Hopefully everything else goes okay. But if it does go well, it's like if I offered you a 1 in 3 chance of something happen. If it hit, I'd give you $10 million. And if it didn't, you had to pay me $100. Like, well, the odds are against you, but you'll still take that bet every single day of the week. Right. So I think it's context matters when you're talking about crypto. If you're trading it, you're crazy. If you're out there trying to pick these things, you really need to take a look in the mirror, because you don't honestly know what you're doing. That's not an insult to you personally. It's because no one does on the short term. You can't.
It's funny, mate. I always want to describe it as a bottom draw investment, which is ironic, because bottom draw is normally that idea of so safe you don't
big
have to bother looking at it.
Type,
But in this case, it's kind of one of those same things where it's like, if you're paying attention, you are wasting time and probably only giving yourself grief, because as you say, if in 1, 3, 5, 10, 20, whatever that number is in your head, it does add some value. The only thing that can happen between now and then is you get scared out of it, right? And not let the thesis play out. It's probably there's an analog too in investing in shares, I guess, to some degree of for all of the topic we think, for all the time we talk about BHP or Soul Patts or Commonwealth Bank being a bottom draw stock, and you can make the arguments for those. There's almost an argument to say that maybe all your portfolio should be bottom draw stocks, in the same sense that unless you're really dispassionately looking at the results, and we're about to go into earnings season, by the way, we haven't even touched on that.
That's gonna be fun.
But unless you're actually responding really rationally to those things, the chance you get scared out of a stock just because of volatility is actually really high. And so maybe they all should be bottom draw stocks. We should be left alone. And frankly, I'll come back and look either when the business changes meaningfully that I have to look, like Woolies is getting into blockchain. Okay, well, I probably should look at that again because I bought it for grocery retailing. Woolies profits doubled or halved. Okay, maybe you got to have another look. But maybe that's the point, right? That even if Bitcoin can be considered a bottom draw stock, maybe they all should be.
Yeah, I forget, was it Buffett who said that you want to buy an invest, he said share or stock, I'm sure, but let's say it's paraphrased, you want to buy an investment where if the market closed for 10 years, you'd be happy with that.
Yeah.
I think it's, again, it's one of those really simple things that's got a lot of power in it. So that is very much the case in regard to what you're calling bottom draw stocks, or in the case of Bitcoin, where it's sort of like, if I am only allowed to make an investment where it's kind of like a bond that doesn't expire for 10 years, I need to be happy with the money that I'm allocating there, that whatever happens, I just can't touch, because that is kind of the time frame that I'm operating to. And I think if you're right in any way in terms of your long-term thesis, that's the kind of time frames you almost need to think about if you want it to play out. So anyway, I think it's bottom draw. I think Bitcoin's bottom draw. I think you'd be crazy to put you put your whole life savings into it, but 3%, maybe even 5% if you're super ambitious. I think a sensible investor can do that and keep a straight face.
I can't keep a straight face, but I accept that you can, and that the beauty is, mate,
is that you have to wait 10 years to see if I'm right or wrong.
Exactly. So. You don't plan to be on this podcast in 10 years, though. Yeah, yeah.
I'll bail after 9 years.
Today's date is the 29th of July 2022. Someone out there, put a reminder in your calendar and send me an email on the 29th of July 2031, and we'll check him in there. When he's off on his yacht in the Bahamas, because Strawman's done so well for him, we'll get him on the sat phone and check in on his Bitcoin investment and see how that's panned out. I think. Yeah, this is what I do like about discussing stuff that you and I don't agree on, because we agree on a lot, is that reasonable, rational people can take different perspectives on things, and it doesn't make us right or wrong. Eventually someone's going to be more right than the other one by definition. But it does. You know, there are no absolutes in investing. There is no simple single way to do it. For all that you and I agree on, to be able to agree on all that stuff and then still just agree on Bitcoin is kind of the point. So there's some value in that as well.
100%. Yeah.
Hey, will you come back on Sunday?
Love to, mate. Try and stop me.
Oh, that's easy. I just won't. No,
we'll just don't ring up.
Sure, if you want me to. I would accept. I'd have to do the podcast myself, and nobody deserves that. So I will make sure Andrew comes back and sees us on Sunday. Thank you for listening, fools, as always, to the Motley Fool Money podcast. We very much appreciate it. I appreciate Andrew Page from Strawman being my co-host on the podcast. He's a very good man, a lovely bloke, as you say. Tolerates me nicely, which is fine. And I appreciate you tolerating us as well. Thank you for spending your time listening to us. If you do get the opportunity, please do like and review the podcast. Tell your friends. Help us just push it up the charts a little bit. Good for our egos, but hopefully helps other people as well. And if you haven't learnt a couple of things from this podcast, then we're not doing our job. So we hope you have. We hope it's worth sharing. And we hope you'll join us on Sunday. But until then, fool on.
See you next time.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.